pensare.
Ma per l'amore dell'altra.
Potere Operaio merges with Autonomia, the most radical wing of the protest movement. A counter-society should be established and life fundamentally changed. Tumult reigns in the streets and in the people's minds.
Autonomia dice rovesciamo tutto questo. Andiamo dove ci piace.
Franco Berardi. Autonomia says, let's turn it on its head. Let's go where we want to go. Let's wake up when we want to and do the type of activities we like most. This is not counterproductive. On the contrary, this represents the height of possible productivity in a world in which the determining force of production is knowledge, not material labor.
Per fare tutto. Occupazione di casa, occupazione di mensa, occupazione di fabbrica, occupazione di...
Pino Triposi, Autonomia activist. We were studying, but there was time for everything. Squatting flats, squatting canteens, squatting factories, squatting everything. We don't want to pay for the tram. We don't want to pay for the cinema. So we won't. We don't like the film. So we'll turn it off and discuss why we don't like it. We don't like how they make TV programs. So we'll do something to transform them.
Telephone and electrical rates are self-reduced without authorization. Supermarkets are emptied and their contents redistributed. For Negri, the theorist of Autonomia, these actions constitute a reappropriation of society's accumulated wealth. Capitalism and exploitation should be abolished, with violence in the streets, if necessary. This marks the most ambivalent period in Negri's writing. The state later holds these writings to be morally responsible for the escalation of terrorist violence.
Poi negli anni 70 ha cominciato a essere un po' considerato un po' un capo.
Anna Negri, Antonio's sister. In the 1970s, he began being considered a sort of head of the movement. Many people spoke of him as if he were the only one authorized to speak. Many considered him to be an important person. And being considered important became the basis for others to see him as the mastermind controlling the revolution somehow.
The political situation in Italy is unstable. The state feels threatened from both the right and the left. The Christian Democrats want to form a coalition with the Communist Party, the so-called historic compromise. For the radical movement Autonomia, this is betrayal. The situation explodes in Bologna and Rome. Open confrontations with the state follow.
Cioè, praticamente ci sono 100.000 persone almeno che si riuniscono a Roma.
There was something like 100,000 people meeting in Rome. The papers referred to it as the Second March on Rome. The police were armed to the teeth to defend the Roman palazzi. So there was this heavily armed demonstration. The situation was very dramatic and ended with lots of arrests. There was heavy fighting throughout Rome. It had an insurrectional character, the demonstrations of May and June 1977.
Credo che tutta la mia generazione è stata...
Elisa Del Rey. I think that my entire generation was involved in a very difficult, very divisive process of choosing. On the other hand, we had the feeling that we could change the world, that there was a concrete and real chance to change it. One could even accept that all methods were allowed, that all means were useful. Refusing to use certain means, to put it bluntly, murder or terrorist acts, this was a difficult choice. Very difficult.
The Autonomia movement has come to a dead end. Above all, the violence question provokes unbridgeable differences between fractions in the movement. It is a time of rising influence for the Red Brigades. Many activists decide to go underground and operate illegally. The state answers with tanks in the streets.
One of the things that no one remembers well is the feeling of general enthusiasm generated by the first Red Brigade's kidnappings that didn't end in death, rather in the liberation of a person. It was a liberating moment, a demonstration of strength. We too are strong, like the capitalists and industrialists. After that, of course, there was the shock of facing the real deaths.
In 1978, Aldo Moro, the chairman of the Christian Democrats, is kidnapped and his bodyguards shot. The Red Brigades claim responsibility for the kidnapping. A military logic has prevailed, from which Negri distances himself.
Negri, that's the moment everyone realized, the comrades who shared my convictions, they all realized that we were facing a fatal deadline, so to speak. There was immense pressure to release Moro, immense pressure passing through channels more or less familiar to us. For example, from the Socialist Party, because Craxi was the only one who wanted Moro to be saved at all costs.
Salvato. Cioè io mi ricordo che lì si stava cercando ancora di dare una fisonomia, una figura.
Johnny Minardi. I remember that we were still trying to create a public profile for Autonomia. We had organized a successful strike at the Alfa Romeo plant. So I was standing in front of Alfa Romeo in Milan around 7:30 when the news arrived. I said, "It's over, boys."
2 months later, the body of Aldo Moro is found in Rome. Almost a year later, the state moves against the intellectual leaders of the Autonomia movement. On April 7, 1979, they are arrested. In the following years, 60,000 activists are investigated and 25,000 arrested. Special laws allow defendants to be held in jail for years. It is the first step of a massive retaliation by the state against the Italian left.
Negri. I found myself in prison, charged with 17 murders, including Moro's. I was identified as having been at the scene of the crime. I didn't expect to be accused of being the head of both the movement and the Red Brigades.
Negri is charged with maintaining subversive associations, political conspiracy, the establishment of an armed gang, armed resistance against the state, and participation in the abduction and murder of Aldo Moro.
At the beginning, they were convinced that we were the heads of the Red Brigades, so they put us together. Our relationship with the Brigatisti had always been very polemical. It ended in two larger confrontations. The first was in prison in Palmi in Calabria, where I was tried by the Brigatisti and sentenced to death because I kept making the speeches I had always made. First, that the Moro affair was mad and suicidal. Second, in regard to the German question, the one about the RAF, that I said that our comrades in prison had definitely been killed, but that they had very probably also wanted to die because the movement was finished and because the whole European terrorist operation was basically suicidal. Obviously, my conclusions were therefore that we had to try to negotiate from the inside, demobilize on the outside, and make peace. After that, I was known as a traitor for a few years. But then the grand phenomenon of penitence began, and it was difficult to call Negri a traitor. Negri, who never repented, who kept his mouth shut, who refused to be interrogated by judges. During the trial, I defended the movement up to the end. By and by, the penitents were the worst of those who confronted me.
A wave of repression spreads over Italy. The trials continue for decades while the accused remain behind bars. The state has won, and power relations have been re-established. A whole generation that desired to change Italian society is jailed or in exile.
Io non è che fossi il capo di un movimento.
I was never the head of a movement. I was part of a movement. All the mistakes I made with other people. I wish I had the might to say, one should do this, not that. Being a part of a movement means accepting its weight. There are some responsibilities, but you have to consider them from an historical point of view, as political mistakes rather than as simply moral responsibilities. This doesn't mean that there aren't any moral responsibilities. And yet, in the end, behavior in those situations is mass behavior. There is no possibility for anyone, including myself, to control historical processes.
Negri spends 4 years in jail. He uses the work on his book about the philosopher Baruch Spinoza for a new beginning.
I found Spinoza a reason to survive. Spinoza wasn't merely a philosophical study to work through. He was a great intellectual with whom one could discuss and chat, with whom one discovers in the end that legislation, the state, may put me in prison, but the power of the human being, the power of life, always goes on.
In aula, ma Tony Negri è stato l'unico a fare eccezione entrando, come vedremo ora, anche nelle immagini.
In 1983, while still in prison, Negri is spectacularly elected into parliament as a representative of the Radical Party. He is given parliamentary immunity and is released. A few months later, he learns that his immunity is about to be revoked.
E così ho deciso di partire, evidentemente con molti.
So I decided to leave. Of course, I had many doubts, especially because I'm someone who's very loyal to comrades and friends. I feel very close to people. It was a difficult decision for me to leave. Then there was a ferocious attack in the media, especially by the PCI, the Communist Party. It was a very hard attack. First you lecture with your silver tongue, and then you go.
Negri is condemned in absentia to 30 years in prison, a sentence that will later be reduced to 18 years. The charges of murdering Aldo Moro and armed resistance against the state are dropped. But Negri is convicted of being the head of Autonomia and of inciting criminal activities with his writings. Negri flees to Paris, where a scene of Italian political activists from the 1970s is living in exile. The socialist government of François Mitterrand tolerates him and many others. Here he will spend the next 14 years without papers.
Lui a Parigi i primi sei mesi è rimasto molto solo.
Anna Negri. In Paris, he was very lonely for the first 6 months. He had lots of friends in Paris, but he didn't know whether the Italians were going to get their extradition or not. They had applied for it immediately. Jan Mollier-Boutin, publicist and friend of Negri. The way Italian judges decided on extraditions was scandalous. The lawyer Klejman called it a judiciary slapstick. When he heard about the accusations, he couldn't believe his eyes. The political dimension was obvious, laughable. The testimony they used didn't hold together at all.
Renowned friends and philosophers Félix Guattari and Gilles Deleuze helped Negri to establish himself in Paris.
Negri. Félix's help was extremely important. For a couple of years, I was called Antoine Guattari because of the rent, the contracts, the telephone, etc. Félix went to do it all for me because I didn't have any papers or documents.
Negri focuses his attention on philosophy. It is a period of reconstruction.
We established a philosophical relationship, not just an outgrowth of our friendship, but a distinct relationship within the discourse. As Hart says, in the 19th century, philosophy was made in Germany and the battles were fought in France. In the second half of the 20th century, the battles were fought in Italy and the philosophy was made in France.
Complètement compris le côté antidialectique ou adialectique.
Jan Mollier-Boutin. He understood the anti-dialectical or adialectical aspect of the philosophy of Deleuze, Foucault, and the currents in France. These differential aspects helped him break from traditional Marxism.
With help from Deleuze and Guattari, Negri can teach at the Sorbonne Paris 8, an institute of contemporary French philosophy. Negri seminars become a showcase for a new school of critical thought.
Michael Hart, co-author, Empire.
Of the Italian exiles in Paris, Tony was the best known and the and also the he was at least for many a central, let's say, intellectual figure. But Tony also was able. This seems to me the great project of those years of his, which was to construct in Paris, to construct with the French intellectual scene a new pole of thinking.
From his French colleagues, Negri adopts the idea that power can no longer be located at a fixed center, but rather infuses all aspects of life. He speaks of biopolitics and radicalizes the concept of the social worker from the 1970s. Now all of society is part of the production process and thus defined by exploitation.
E lo sfruttamento, in effetti, che come è fatto? Lo sfruttamento è fatto.
Negri, how does exploitation happen? Exploitation happens when social elements, social fragments are put together and the ability to communicate is recovered. Today, the ability to communicate determines a product's value.
Negri employs the term immaterial labor. He reflects on the realization that most wealth in a post-industrial economy is no longer achieved with physical labor, but through the use of knowledge and language. The intellectual and social abilities of workers determine the complex production processes of our time. For Negri, the question becomes, how's global political power organized in the 21st century, and how can political opposition emerge from a multitude of political perspectives? Work on the book Empire begins.
Ecco, quindi Impero è un po' il riassunto, diciamo così, dei 14 anni passati in Francia.
Empire is somehow the summary of the 14 years spent in France on one hand. It's an analysis of the transformation of labor and therefore of social control structures. On the other hand, it's an analysis of the crisis in modern Western politics. These elements met and merged in Empire.
Drawn to this new school of thought, a young generation of activists arrives in Paris. Many of them are Italians who are searching for the professor in exile. Through them, Negri's connections to Italy are revived.
Noi andavamo ad incontrare dei latitanti, quindi l'elemento anche mitologico.
Luca Casarini, activist disobbedienti. We met these people in exile. They were surrounded by a myth, but they also embodied living experience. We got to Paris and found them all together. We thought, although we were oversimplifying, that it was a community living underground, so to speak, and so they were continuing to work and stick together. It's much more complicated, but that's how I saw it then.
In 1997, after 14 years of exile in Paris, Negri decides to return to Italy. He hopes that by turning himself into the Italian authorities, he can revive the debate about amnesty for the exiles and political prisoners from the 1970s. He wants to come to terms with his past so that he can become politically active again in Italy. As Negri boards the plane, he leaves friends and an esteemed existence in Paris behind him. A step into the unknown.
Michael Hart.
The decision was, in a way, long in coming. I mean, there had been years he had been thinking that that was something he needed to do. So it wasn't. In fact, I was one of the only ones, at least in the Paris group, and maybe I was wrong, I was one of the only ones who thought that that was right, who said that it was the right decision. It seemed to me the right decision at the time. It seemed to everyone else. Although Tony, of course, you know, he's stuck in his ideas no matter what people tell him, he's going to do it. So it's not like people influenced him, but the vast majority of the friends in Paris and in Italy thought it was a terrible idea.
Sentivo, con molto anticipo probabilmente, ma lo sentivo con grande forza, la rinascita di un movimento in Italia.
I felt long before it happened, but very distinctively, the rise of a movement in Italy. I often have this sort of feeling, a smell or special sensitivity for this sort of thing. I am in no way a prophet, but I can feel these things in advance. So I had this intuition, and then there was a political opportunity that I discussed with many Italian politicians and the bicameral commission. The chance was greater than 50%, let's say 60-70% for getting amnesty.
Immediately upon arriving in Rome, he's arrested and thrown in jail. Instead of amnesty, the 64-year-old faces prison and house arrest. The past has caught up with him. Meanwhile, Empire, the book Negri co-authored with Michael Hart, is published in the United States. It becomes a world bestseller and is celebrated as the Communist Manifesto of the 21st century. Negri and Hart have devised a new political vocabulary and outlined a vision of revolt in the globalized world. At the same time, the anti-globalization movement grabs the world's attention, first in Seattle and then in Genoa. In this context, Negri and Hart's work appears to offer theoretical reflection on the unfolding events. The empire does not fortify its boundaries to push others away, but rather pulls them within its specific order, like a powerful vortex. With boundaries and differences suppressed or set aside, the empire is a kind of smooth space across which subjectivities glide without substantial resistance or conflict.
What one shouldn't forget is that there's always a kind of theorizing that goes on in the movements. It's not like the people in the movements are only receiving ideas from the great thinkers, or that they're only involved in practical situations. And so I think it's then, you know, therefore important that in all the movements there's whatever, developed discussions about theoretical issues, and there are. And so that I think a book like ours can fit as one element in these kinds of discussions.
Despite international attention, Negri isn't freed until the spring of 2003. His passport is returned to him and he's allowed to travel.
Me lo ricordo molto bene il primo giorno che lui è uscito in permesso.
Judith Revelle, Negri's partner. I remember very clearly the first day he was given leave. It was a 3-day permit, fully supervised. We had a plainclothes agent following us all the time. I was scared of violent reactions for a long time. I still am. There were so many horrible political reactions in the papers. People still say 30 years later, that's the one who killed Moro. It wasn't only driving me insane, it was making me really sick.
Negri can neither teach nor exercise his right to vote in Italy. But overnight he has become a highly acclaimed speaker around the world.
We have to cut away the very base of capital. The only way to eradicate the exploitation that is the base of capital, is to develop the ability to take things into our own hands, to socially organize and self-manage our own intellectual capacities.
For Negri, resistance develops on a global level through networks, but it also takes the form of local conflicts. The forms of revolt have changed, but they are still a part of larger struggle against exploitation.
What is violence? Violence is exploitation, above and most of all. If we forget that, we have really lost the ability to see. This fundamental form of exploitation has to be stopped by the strength, the reaction, the response of the exploited subject. The exploited subject is an intelligent subject. It is mobile, flexible, a swarming out subject. That's what I call it. It thickens and enlarges inside production, inside social life.
Negri has developed a new class concept, the multitude. The term describes constellations of creatively productive individuals. It differs from older concepts such as the masses, the people, or the nation. This intelligent, flexible, and mobile multitude defends itself in parallel actions around the world against exploitation by global power structures, against empire. In Negri's vision, it becomes a swarm of globally active resistance. The whole world has suddenly become a stage for Negri, the former enemy of the state. He's surprised a bit himself about this dance with the media.
Es ist eine Gesamtheit von unterschiedlichen
Qualitäten. The Disobedience are an activist group from Negri's former home, Porto Marghera. Their spectacular actions reference the main concepts of empire. Among other things, they demand subsistence money for everybody.
Luca Casarini. Disobedience was and still is an important political and cultural space because it introduces the idea that you can and must disobey orders. Disobedience is, for example, to refuse to go to war or to refuse to take orders. Not obeying orders opens up spaces. By not obeying, you no longer recognize power. Or maybe you do recognize it, but want to oppose it. So you introduce the theme of conflict.
Conflict also means disobedience in regards to borders and asylum laws. A main focus of revolt today for Negri is opposition to war. It too has changed in the age of empire.
It was a war that no longer wanted to present itself as a war between states, but as a war against a public enemy, against an internal reality. It came to be defined as dangerous. It is no longer the old imperialistic war in which single nations expand their power. This is a war in the name of global capitalism. This war is a process of organization on a global level. We are the real internationalists when it comes down to it. But only when, and to the extent to which we understand, that this empire is coming into form as we speak.
Quando mi guardo indietro dico, io ho fatto 16 anni di carcere e dico, e poi 25, 14.
When I look back and think, I spent 16 years in prison, 14 in exile. It's a lifetime. It's mad. But if you manage to live it, to continue to learn and to work, in the end, it's a life like any other. You've been listening to a radio adaptation of Antonio Negri, The Revolt That Never Ends, a film by Alexandre Veltz and Andreas Pichler, released in 2004. This is Unwelcome Guests.
You can say that it's about the savages. You can say you have a better way to live. You can call it manifest destiny. You can talk of all your civilization will give. You can say that we're a thing of history, and progress is the future you will bring. You can send your armies to these mountains. You can say we'll prosper beneath your king. But there will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose. You can say you've got to stop the communists. You can say that our ideals can't succeed. You can say that competition is the only way, and a global system based on greed. You can call yourself a Democrat, you can call yourself whatever you will. You can keep on stamping out the fires you start, so you might stay on top of the hill. But there will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. Our future is not yours to choose. You could say that all of us are terrorists, madmen bent on destroying all that's free. You can say that we are building weapons as your bombers fly from sea to bloody sea. You can say you're with us or against us, and to die quietly is what we now must do. You can maintain your innocence. You can say that you are many as you represent the few. But there will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose.
We'll conclude the program with the next installment of a reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto, beginning Chapter 9. The Cult of Scientific Management, that deals with the institutionalization of dehumanization for workers within the industrial system, and the role of schooling in this, all under the rubric of efficiency. Efficient for corporate owners to maximize profits, that is. It would hardly need to be said, except for the fact that it almost is never said in the media, that spending your life doing something you hate, that stunts you, so someone else can get rich, is not productive nor efficient for you. It is the highest form of waste, that of your whole life. For those just joining the program, John Taylor Gatto, the author of the book I'm reading to you, spent 30 years and won many awards as a teacher in New York City. He had a realization over time that led to his resignation from the profession, that schools were not making people smarter nor better in any way. He had a suspicion, which his research has subsequently verified, that the dumbed-down students he saw were not the result of the failure of schools to live up to their goals, but rather were the goal of the industrialists who financed the movement for compulsory schooling in America. Gatto begins Chapter 9 as follows. On the night of June 9, 1834, a group of prominent men, quote, chiefly engaged in commerce, gathered privately in a Boston drawing room to discuss a scheme of universal schooling. Secretary of this meeting was William Ellery Channing, Horace Mann's own minister, as well as an international figure and the leading Unitarian of his day. The location of the meeting house is not entered in the minutes, nor are the names of the assembly's participants apart from Channing. Even though the literacy rate in Massachusetts was 98%, and in neighboring Connecticut 99.8%, the assembled businessmen agreed the present system of schooling allowed too much to depend upon chance. It encouraged more entrepreneurial exuberance than the social system could bear. The minutes of this meeting are in the Appleton Papers collection at the Massachusetts Historical Society. The first man on record to perceive how much additional production could be extracted from close regulation of labor was Frederick Winslow Taylor, son of a wealthy Philadelphia lawyer. "What I demand of the worker," Taylor said, "is not to produce any longer by his own initiative, but to execute punctiliously the orders given down to their minutest details. The Taylors, a prominent Quaker family from Germantown, Pennsylvania, had taken Freddie to Europe for 3 years from 1869 to 1872, where he was attending an aristocratic German academy when von Moltke's Prussian Blitzkrieg culminated at the French disaster at Sedan and a German empire was finally proclaimed, ending 1,000 years of disunion. Prussian schooling was the widely credited forge which made those miracles possible. The jubilation which spread through Germany underlined a presumably fatal difference between political systems which disciplined with ruthless efficiency, like Prussia's socialist paradise, and those devoted to whimsy and luxury like France. The lesson wasn't lost on little Fred. Near the conclusion of his Principles of Scientific Management, published 39 years later in 1911, Taylor summarized the new managerial discipline as follows. 1. A regimen of science, not rule of thumb. 2. An emphasis on harmony, not the discord of competition. 3. An insistence on cooperation, not individualism. 4. A fixation on maximum output. 5. The development of each man to his greatest productivity. Taylor's biographers, Reg and Greenwood, wrote, "He left us a great legacy. Frederick Taylor advanced a total system of management, one which he built from pieces taken from numerous others whom he would rarely credit. His genius lies in being a missionary." After Taylor's death in 1915, the Frederick W. Taylor Cooperators were formed to project his scientific management movement into the future. Frank Copley called Taylor a man whose heart was aflame with missionary zeal. Much about this Quaker-turned-Unitarian, who married into an Arbella-descended Puritan family before finally becoming an Episcopalian, bears decisively on the shape schooling took in this country. Reg and Greenwood describe him as, quote, "often arrogant, somewhat caustic, and inflexible in how his system should be implemented. Taylor was cerebral, like a machine he was polished, and he was also intellectual. Taylor's brilliant reasoning was marred when he attempted to articulate it, for his delivery was often demeaning, even derogatory at times," close quote. Frank Gilbreth's motion study says, quote, "It is the never-ceasing marvel concerning this man that age cannot wither nor custom stale his work. After many a weary day's study, the investigator awakes from a dream of greatness to find he has only worked out a new proof for a problem Taylor has already solved. Time study, the instruction card, functional foremanship, the differential rate piece method of compensation, and numerous other scientifically derived methods of decreasing costs and increasing output and wages, these are by no means his only contributions to standardizing the trades." To fully grasp the effect of Taylor's industrial evangelism on American national schooling, you need to listen to him play teacher in his own words to Schmidt at Bethlehem Steel in the 1890s. Quote, "Now, Schmidt, you're a first-class pig iron handler and know your business well. You've been handling at a rate of 12.5 tons per day. I have given considerable study to handling pig iron, and I feel you could handle 47 tons of pig iron per day if you really tried, instead of 12.5 tons. Skeptical but willing, Schmidt started to work, and all day long and at regular intervals was told by the men who stood over him with a watch, 'Now pick up a pig and walk. Now sit down and rest. Now walk, rest, etc.' He worked when he was told to work, and rested when he was told to rest, and at 5:30 in the afternoon had his 47 tons loaded on the car." The incident described above, incidentally, is a fabrication. There was no Schmidt, except in Taylor's mind, just as there was no close observation of Prussian schools by man. Below, he testifies before Congress in 1912, quote, "There is a right way of forcing the shovel into materials and many wrong ways. Now, The way to shovel refractory stuff is to press the forearm hard against the upper part of the right leg just below the thigh, like this. Take the end of the shovel in your right hand, and when you push the shovel into the pile, instead of using the muscular effort of the arms, which is tiresome, throw the weight of your body onto the shovel like this. That pushes your shovel into the pile with hardly any exertion and without tiring the arms in the least. Close quote. Harlow Person called Taylor's approach to the simplest tasks of working life a meaningful and fundamental break with the past. Scientific management, or Taylorism, had four characteristics designed to make the worker, quote, an interchangeable part of an interchangeable machine making interchangeable parts, close quote. Since each quickly found its analog in scientific schooling, let me show them to you. 1. A mechanically controlled work pace. 2. The repetition of simple motions. 3. Tools and techniques selected for the worker. 4. Only superficial attention is asked from the worker, just enough to keep up with the moving line. The connection to all of school procedure is apparent. In the past, Taylor wrote, man has been first. In the future, the system must be first. It is not sufficient to have physical movements standardized. The standardized worker must be happy in his work, too. Therefore, his thought processes also must be standardized. Scientific management was applied wholesale in American industry in the decade after 1910. It spread quickly to schools. In the preface to the classic study on the effects of scientific management on schooling in America, Education and the Cult of Efficiency, Raymond Callahan explains that when he set out to write, his intent was to explore the origin and development of business values in educational administration, an occurrence he tracks to about 1900. Callahan wanted to know why school administrators had adopted business practices and management parameters of assessment when education is not a business, the school is not a factory. Could the inappropriate procedure be explained simply by a familiar process in which ideas and values flow from high-status groups to those of lesser distinction? As Callahan put it, it does not take profound knowledge of American education to know that educators are, and have been, a relatively low-status, low-power group, but the degree of intellectual domination shocked him. Quote, what was unexpected was the extent not only of the power of business industrial groups, but of the strength of the business ideology and the extreme weakness and vulnerability of school administrators. I had expected more professional autonomy, and I was completely unprepared for the extent and degree of capitulation by administrators to whatever demands were made upon them. I was surprised and then dismayed to learn how many decisions they made or were forced to make, not on educational grounds, but as a means of appeasing their critics in order to maintain their positions in the school. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. In 1903, the Atlantic Monthly called for adoption of business organization by schools, and William C. Bagley identified the ideal teacher as one who would rigidly hew to the line. Bagley's ideal school was a place strictly reduced to rigid routine. He repeatedly stressed in his writing a need for unquestioned obedience. Before 1900, school boards were large, clumsy organizations with a seat available to represent every interest. They often had 30 to 50 members. A great transformation was engineered in the first decade of the 20th century, however, and after 1910 they were dominated by businessmen, lawyers, real estate men, and politicians. Business pressure extended from the kindergarten rung of the new school ladder all the way to the German-inspired teacher training schools. The Atlantic Monthly approved what it had earlier asked for, saying in 1910, our universities are beginning to run as business colleges. Successful industrial leaders were featured regularly in the press, holding forth on their success, but seldom attributing it to book learning or scholarship. Carnegie, self-educated in libraries, appears in his writings and public appearances as the leading school critic of the day. echoing Carnegie, the governor of Michigan, welcomed an NEA convention to Detroit with his injunction, quote, "The demand of the age is for practical education." The state superintendent of public instruction in Michigan followed the governor, quote, "The character of our education must change with the oncoming of the years of this highly practical age. We have educated the mind to think and trained the vocal organs to express the thought, and we have forgotten the fact that in 4 times out of 5, the practical man expresses his thought by the hand rather than by mere words." Close quote. Something was cooking. The message was clear. Academic education had become a strange kind of national emergency, just as had been prophesied by the Department of Education's Circular of Information in 1871 and 1872. 20 years later, Francis Parker praised the elite Committee of Ten under Harvard President Charles Eliot for rejecting tracking, the practice of school class assignment based upon future social destination. The committee had come down squarely for common schools, an ideal that Parker said was worth all the pains necessary to produce the report. The conclusion is that there should be no such thing as class education. Close quote. Parker had noticed the start of an attempt to provide common people with only partial education. He was relieved that it had been turned back. Or so he thought. The pronouncements of the Committee of Ten turned out to be the last gasp of the common school notion, apart from the 4th of July rhetoric. The common school was being buried by the determination of new tycoon class businessmen to see the demise of an older democratic republican order and its dangerous libertarian ideals. If educators, as they were self-consciously beginning to refer to themselves, had any misunderstanding of what was expected by 1910, NEA meetings of that year were specifically designed to clear them up. Attendees were told the business community had judged their work to be theoretical, visionary, and impractical. All over the country, our courses are being attacked, and the demand for revision is along the line of fitting mathematical teaching to the needs of the masses. Close quote. In 1909, Leonard Ayres charged in Laggards in Our Schools that although these institutions were filled with retarded children, school programs were, alas, fitted to the unusually bright one. Ayres invented means for measuring the efficiency of school systems by computing the dropout holdover rate, a game still in evidence today. This was begging the question with a vengeance, but no challenge to this assessment was ever raised. Taylor's system of management efficiency was being formally taught at Harvard and Dartmouth by 1910. In the next year, 219 articles on the subject appeared in magazines. Hundreds more followed. By 1917, a bibliography of 550 school management science references was available from a Boston publisher. As the steel core of school reform, scientific management enjoyed national recognition. It was the main topic at the 1913 convention of the Department of Superintendents. Paul Hannes, professor of education at Harvard, launched a series of books for the World Book Company under the title School Efficiency Series. And famous muckraker J.M. Price published his own Scientific Management in Education in 1913, showing local ward schooling an arena of lowlives and grifters. Frederick Taylor's influence was not limited to America. It soon circled the globe. Principles of scientific management spread the efficiency mania all over Europe, Japan, and China. A letter to the editor of The Nation in 1911 gives the flavor of what was happening. "I am tired of scientific management, so-called. I have heard of it from scientific managers, from university presidents, from casual acquaintances in railway trains. I have read of it in the daily papers, the weekly paper, the 10-cent magazine, and in the Outlook. I have only missed its treatment by Theodore Roosevelt, but that is probably because I cannot keep up with his writings. For 15 years, I have been a subscriber to a magazine dealing with engineering matters, feeling it incumbent upon me to keep in touch. But the touch has become a pressure, the pressure a crushing strain. until the mass of articles on shop practice and scientific management threatened to crush all thought out of my brain, and I stopped my subscription. Close quote. In an article from Izvestia dated April 1918, Lenin urged the system upon Russians. And I'm reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. An anti-intellectual, a hater of individuals, is the way Richard Stites characterizes Taylor in Revolutionary Dreams, his book on the utopian beginning of the Soviet era. Says Stites, his system is the basis for virtually every twisted dystopia in our century, from death under the gas bell in Zamyatin's We for the unspeakable crime of deviance, to the maintenance of a fictitious state-operated underground in Orwell's 1984 in order to draw deviants into disclosing who they are. Close quote. Oddly enough, an actual scheme of dissident entrapment was the brainchild of J.P. Morgan. His unique contribution to the Cecil Rhodes-inspired Round Table Group. Morgan contended that revolution could be subverted permanently by infiltrating the underground and subsidizing it. In this way, the thinking of the opposition could be known as it developed and fatally compromised. Corporate, government, and foundation cash grants to subversives might be one way to derail the train of insurrection that Hegelian theory predicted would arise against every ruling class. As this practice matured, the insights of Fabian socialism were stirred into the mix. Gradually, a socialist leveling through practices pioneered in Bismarck's Prussia came to be seen as the most efficient control system for the masses, the bottom 80% of the population in advanced industrial states. For the rest, an invigorating system of laissez-faire market competition would keep the advanced breeding stock on its toes. A large portion of the intellectual left jumped on Taylor's bandwagon, even as labor universally opposed it. Lenin himself was an aggressive advocate. Quote, "The war taught us much, not only that people suffered, but especially the fact that those who have the best technology, organization, discipline, and the best machines emerge on top. It is this the war has taught us. It is essential to learn that without machines, without discipline, it is impossible to live in modern society. It is necessary to master the highest technology or be crushed." Close quote. But even in Russia, workers resisted Taylorish methods. The rebellion of the Kronstadt Commune in 1921 charged that Bolsheviks were planning to introduce the sweat labor system of Taylor. They were right. Taylor distilled the essence of Bismarck's Prussian school training under whose regimen he had witnessed the first-hand defeat of France in 1871. His American synthesis of these disciplines made him the direct inspiration for Henry Ford and Fordism. Between 1895 and 1915, Ford radically transformed factory procedure, relying on Taylorized management and a mass production assembly line marked by precision, continuity, coordination, speed, and standardization. Ford wrote two extraordinary essays in the 1920s, The Meaning of Time and Machinery, the New Messiah, in which he equated planning, timing, precision, and the rest of the scientific management catalog with the great moral meaning of life. Quote, "A clean factory, clean tools, accurate gauges, and precise methods of manufacture produce a smooth working, efficient machine, just as clean thinking, clean living, and square dealing make for a decent home life." Close quote. By the 1920s, the reality of the Ford system paralleled the rules of a Prussian infantry regiment. Both were places where workers were held under close surveillance, kept silent, and punished for small infractions. Ford was unmoved by labor complaints. Men were disposable cogs in his machine. Quote, "A great business is really too big to be human," close quote, he commented in 1929. Fordism and Taylorism swept the Soviet Union as they had swept the United States and Western Europe. By the 1920s, the words Fordizatia and Taylorizatia, both appellations describing good work habits, were common across Russia. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. In May of 1911, the first salvo of a sustained national press attack on the academic ambitions of public schooling was fired. For the previous 10 years, the idea of school as an oasis of mental development, built around a common high-level curriculum, had been steadily undermined by the rise of educational psychology and its empty child-elastic-elastic-child hypothesis. Psychology was a business from the first, an aggressive business lobbying for jobs and school contracts. But resistance of parents, community groups, and students themselves to the new psychologized schooling was formidable. As the summer of 1911 approached, the influential Educational Review gave educators something grim to muse upon as they prepared to clean out their desks. Quote, "Must definite reforms with measurable results be forsworn?" it asked. "That an antiquated school system may grind out useless produce?" close quote. The magazine demanded quantifiable proof of schools' contributions to society, or education should have its budget cut. The article titled "An Economic Measure of School Efficiency" charged that, quote, "The advocate of pure water or clean streets shows by how much the death rate will be altered with each proposed addition to his share of the budget. Only a teacher is without such figures," close quote. An editorial in Ladies' Home Journal reported that dissatisfaction with schools was increasing, claiming, quote, "On every hand, signs are evident of a widely growing distrust of the effectiveness of the present educational system," close quote. In Providence, the school board was criticized by the local press for declaring a holiday on the Monday preceding Decoration Day to allow a 4-day vacation. This cost the public $5,000 in loss of possible returns on the money invested, readers were informed. Suddenly, school critics were everywhere. A major assault was mounted in two popular journals, Saturday Evening Post and Ladies' Home Journal, with millions each in circulation, both read by leaders of the middle classes. The Post sounded the anti-intellectual theme this way, quote, "Miltonized, Chaucerized, Virgilized, Schillered, physicked and chemicaled, the high school should be of no use in the world, particularly the business world," close quote. Three heavy punches in succession came from Ladies' Home Journal. "The case of 17 million children is our public school system providing an utter failure?" This declaration would seem difficult to top, but the second article did just that. Is public school a failure? It is the most momentous failure in our American life today. And a third, written by the principal of a New York City high school, went even further, entitled "The Danger of Running a Fool Factory." It made this point that education is permeated with errors and hypocrisy. While the dean of Columbia Teachers College, James E. Russell, added that, quote, "If school cannot be made to drop its mental development obsession, the whole system should be abolished." And I've been reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto, a former New York City school teacher who is now one of the leading advocates of homeschooling and self-directed education that he calls unschooling. You can read more about his work at johntaylorgatto.com, as well as download this entire book online for free. And you can download this and all previous episodes of this show at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. And thanks to Fred Wien, the IVAW, Sari Gelzer, Alexandra Valtz, and Andreas Pichler for their contributions to this week's program. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.